I was overwhelmed. Ma had begun spending every hour of her day curled up in bed, yanking at her hair and sucking on her thumb. She had devolved into a wordless, infantilized victim, and I had no idea how to help. During one visit, I discovered her entire body was now ravaged with bright red bedsores. Was this my fault? Did I really abandon my own mother? Maybe if I hadn't gone to college, if I had stayed home and gotten a full-time job, she wouldn't be so broken. That was the night my random crying fits began. While showering, I spaced out and found myself crying in a ball on the floor of the bathtub. Throughout the school week, all I could think about was the sight of those bedsores. My mother's body was beginning to fall apart along with her mind. I called Erica, hoping she could help alleviate some of the burden. "She's just being dramatic, like she's always been. Don't fall for it, AJ." She was in a rush to head out with her sorority friends and couldn't talk long. I was filled with rage and envy. I was so mad at her for writing off this ordeal as an act, as if I was wasting my time worrying. But I knew in my heart something was deeply wrong. I was also painfully jealous. Erica was enjoying the college experience and had been for 2 whole years. She was finally getting to act her age, and though she deserved every second of it, I was envious I couldn't. I had grown increasingly isolated, every second spent only on schoolwork and mom-sitting. I felt a crying fit coming on and hid inside the bathroom so my roommate wouldn't see what a mess I was. Running the water, I collapsed onto the bath mat while simultaneously making a mental note to yell at my roomie for never vacuuming. I felt helpless. There was no way I was strong enough to save my mother on my own. Why did I always have to be strong? For once, I just wanted to fall apart and have someone else pick up my tiny pieces. I felt so alone. I wasn't experiencing life the way other freshmen were. I could no longer take jobs in student films or attend club meetings, let alone spend time partying with my roommate. I was too busy momming my mom. Eventually, I became too busy to even sleep. With so much responsibility on my shoulders, my mind raced at night, trying to find solutions. My insomnia returned, stronger than ever. Some weeks I would spend a consecutive 48 hours awake. A fun side effect was once falling asleep while sitting at my desk in class. My giant melon of a head just crashed forward, forehead first, onto the hard surface in front of me. My classmates' amused gasps woke me up. But insomnia felt like a minor quirk to my personality. For the most part, I felt like I was doing my best to keep it together. I did begin exhibiting some odd behavior, though, besides face-planting in class. One afternoon, I prepared to walk downstairs to the cafeteria to pack up a plate for the day. My financial aid package didn't provide me with a generous meal plan, only allowing me to swipe my card 10 times a week. With no money to spend at the grocery store, I would have to make every trip to the cafeteria really count. I would, naturally, get a takeout box, because hungrily eating alongside hundreds of rich kids started to make me nervous, like every eye was fixed on me, like every nose could sniff out the scent of poverty on me. I would ignore the judgmental looks as I piled 3 meals worth of food onto one plate and scurry back upstairs to the safety of my dorm room. I would store the extra food in my small refrigerator for dinner that night and eat at my desk where no one could make me feel small. One day, as I readied to make the trip downstairs, I stopped as my hand reached for the doorknob. I pulled it back and sat on my bed. Do I really need to eat today? There were so many people downstairs, so many eyes that could burn into the flesh on my face. I thought about how hungry I was and decided, yes, of course I need to stock up on food for the day. So I stood up, walked toward the heavy metal door, reached out for the handle, and immediately jerked my hand back. Turning around, I walked back to my bed and sat down. I crossed my legs and began to shake them. Maybe I didn't need food after all. It's just food. It just fuels your body and gives you energy and, oh God, am I really going to starve myself to avoid human contact? I rushed to the door, motivated to kick myself in the ass and stop acting so ridiculously. But as I reached the door, I was frozen with fear. I could not, for the life of me, find the strength to open the door and enter the world. I was safe in these 200 square feet of isolation. Opening the door meant seeing people, talking to people, being judged for scooping too much mashed potatoes onto my plate, listening to the card swipe guy tell me to smile more, walking past the lobby's security guards who probably thought I was a loiterer, and son of a bitch, I can't breathe! And so, over trying to decide to turn a door handle, I had another panic attack. Except this time, I had no nebulizer to strap on my mouth and no one around to calm me down. I turned the shower on as cold as possible and jumped in, fully clothed. After a few freezing minutes, I had everything under control. A few weeks later, while running to get to a class on time, I stopped in my tracks, distracted by a poster pinned to a bulletin board. "Don't jump," the poster implored. It listed the names and numbers of several school counselors who were available if anyone needed someone to talk to about their problems. At the time, NYU had tragically lost several students to suicide. Over the past few years, almost a dozen students had jumped from their tall dorm room windows or over the railing in the high-rise library to their deaths. As a result, all the dorm room windows had been configured to only crack open a few inches, and the library railings had been barricaded. It made for a somber reminder of how stressful college, especially in a busy city, can be for some kids. As I read the poster, I thought of my mother. I wished I could find someone for her to talk to. But if I couldn't convince her to seek out help, maybe I could seek it out for her. Maybe by just relaying my mother's problems to a counselor, I could be given advice on how to help her. Jotting down one of the phone numbers, I felt a small sense of excitement. Perhaps I had found the answers I was looking for. Sitting down with a counselor for the first time was an awkward experience. I had talked to a guidance counselor in high school, but that was primarily about applying to college and why there were so many curse words in my poetry. I had never locked eyes with someone who was so interested in finding out what was bothering me. In a way, I felt like I was ignoring everything my parents had taught me. We weren't supposed to reach out to anyone for help. We weren't supposed to admit there was a weakness inside of us. I felt like I was betraying my mother by exposing her secrets to a stranger. But I didn't think I had any other option. I kept trying to explain that this visit wasn't really for me. It was for my mom. But the counselor didn't seem to pay that any mind. Instead, he kept asking me questions about myself. How does that make you feel? What do you think that means? How is this affecting you? I told him about my panic attacks and my insomnia, and I mentioned the sporadic crying, but tried to explain that these were all just normal reactions to stress. "They're not normal," he plainly put it. "I think you're experiencing depression. I would like to refer you to a psychiatrist." I almost stormed out. How dare he assume I was broken? I was just trying to help someone else who really was falling apart, and maybe I wasn't handling it so well. This guy had known me for an hour's time and wanted to deem me crazy. But as the session went on, I began to actually listen. "Depression is not something you choose. It is a chemical imbalance, which can sometimes be hereditary. If your mother is indeed experiencing these symptoms, there's a chance you can be prone to them as well." He was so calm and matter-of-fact. I was a smart kid, but somehow I hadn't connected those dots. With certainty, I had decided my mother was experiencing some sort of mental illness. But if I would have taken the time, I could have noticed my own reflection in my mother's weary eyes. Realizing the dark force swallowing her up was sizing me up for its next meal felt simultaneously like a ton of bricks had been lifted off and laid on my shoulders. I finally had answers for questions I didn't even know I had. But now I was left with more than just my mother's brain to worry about. If you have a deep cut, you go to a doctor and get a stitch. If you have a cold, you go to a doctor and get medicine. So what makes having something wrong with your brain any different? No one had ever explained it to me like that. So simply, so non-judgmentally. I felt like an idiot for wasting so much time being too ashamed to recognize what was happening in my own head. For so long, I had denied what I was feeling out of fear. I didn't want to accept that something could be wrong with me. I didn't want to feel different. All I needed was for someone to explain that there didn't have to be any shame in taking care of yourself. But now, I needed to figure out where to start. Convincing my parents to see a doctor would be an uphill battle. Convincing myself was even harder. But nevertheless, I made an appointment with the psychiatrist he recommended. I was terrified of what other dark spots on my brain this doctor would shine a light on. But the school was willing to pay for the sessions, and getting free treatment seemed like an offer, no matter how terrifying, I couldn't refuse. It's dangerous to go alone. The first time I went to see a psychiatrist, I was dressed like Carmen Sandiego and was just as determined to not be found. Walking into the waiting room, wearing a hat lowered so dramatically it covered my eyes, I was on edge and deeply embarrassed. What if I saw someone I knew? Would that mean they were crazy too? Should we politely ignore each other? Or was there some sort of existing acknowledgement in the psychiatric community, like a gang sign we could flash to each other? Maybe it was pointing to the side of the head and making a circling motion with the index finger while crossing the eyes. I was sure the office receptionist, growing numb to the revolving door of Nutter Butters, was greeting me with apathy. When she handed me a clipboard without making eye contact and robotically instructed me to fill this out and give it to the doctor, I instead heard, "Oh great, another Looney Tune. Is Nurse Ratched on call today?" Trying to get a lay of the land, I scanned the empty waiting room, reading every cheesy advertisement for antidepressants. Once I get this depression under control, I'll finally be able to jump rope in an open field, I thought. Between the cold receptionist and the overwhelming amount of trite, "life is better on drugs" flyers, I wanted to bolt. But entering the psychiatrist's office, decorated in soft white tones, potted orchids, and two plushy couches, I calmed. Noticing a box of tissues resting on a coffee table between the love seats, I snorted, thinking it was sort of presumptuous and honestly a little vain to believe each patient would fall into a sobbing, revelatory mess in his company. The doctor entered the room with a smile. He was warm and welcoming, which, considering how the nerves I was feeling made my body uncontrollably shake, was clearly essential. "How would you describe your family?" was the first can of worms he asked me to open. I thought about the question for close to 30 seconds, opened my mouth, and immediately imploded in tears. Perhaps I would be in need of that tissue box after all. For the next 40 minutes, we discussed my unconventional upbringing and the pressure I was still feeling. Going to a school counselor, though helpful, had ultimately felt like a sterile clinical experience. "You are sick? Go get help," was the essential theme of the visit. And that was what I was expecting out of this session as well. But something about being in a cozy room across from a person who genuinely wanted to help was surprisingly comforting. The psychiatrist suggested I see a therapist to continue exploring all the feelings that were bubbling beneath the surface. I hadn't realized that a psychiatrist's main focus is diagnosis and treatment. I would have to move forward with a therapist if I wanted to focus on sorting out my muddled mind. He officially diagnosed me with depression and wrote a prescription for antidepressants. Leaving his office, I felt a sense of relief. I had a tangible enemy to fight now. This was probably what my mother was suffering from as well, And though finally having some answers made me feel 10 pounds lighter, I was brought back down to earth by the impossibility of my next steps. It was hard enough to walk into one cold office and bare my goose-bumped soul, but having to do it for the third time with a whole new medical professional was a lot to ask of someone just starting to experiment with treatment. Even more terrifying was the small plastic bottle I picked up from a corner pharmacy. The tiny pills rattled around inside of it like a musical instrument. I wasn't sure how I felt about being medicated. Having a father who had been arrested multiple times for drug possession, finding only Budweiser in the fridge while my stomach growled, and witnessing firsthand the scary altered states of users had made me resentful toward any kind of drugs and alcohol. At the age of 10, I had promised myself I would never touch them, and at 18, I had stayed true to that promise. But could a prescription given by a medical professional, a stitch to an unseen wound, be thrown into the same category? I wasn't sure. Tackling the easier task first, I made an appointment with a therapist the psychiatrist had recommended. And thank whatever God might be real that I did. First of all, the therapist's receptionist was much kinder. The waiting room was decorated with hilarious, inspirational art, not unlike the "hang in there, kitten" holding on to a tree limb poster I have as my laptop screensaver. The therapist was quirky and sweet, and again, I felt safe. Giving therapy a chance was one of the best decisions I have ever made. I had never had someone's complete focus and attention before. I had never been asked how I felt about being in the situations I had been dragged through in life. For the first time, I felt like I was allowed to break down. I didn't have to be the strong leader of the Mendez clan. I didn't have to hold everything together. I handed the reins over to someone else and allowed myself to melt into an almost euphoric defenselessness. I found the one place on earth it was safe to let my guard down. The therapist suggested I start a journal. Each week, he planned on giving me a different essay assignment I would bring into the office to read aloud. He said it would be like an exercise for my emotions, which were apparently a little pudgy. The homework ranged from writing a letter to my past self, to a letter to my future daughter, to a list of things I wish I could yell at my mother, to a list of things I am ashamed of. At first, this seemed just as corny as the inspirational quotes framed on the wall behind him, but I actually came to find them surprisingly helpful. I also enjoyed cutting out letters from magazines to tape a hodgepodge diary of an unfit mind across my journal's cover like a serial killer. It felt good to connect to writing again. Filling an empty page had always been my own form of therapy, except now I was the subject. After a few sessions, I could feel myself growing calmer and stronger. It was almost too good to be true. Would it be this easy to fix my mother? Is this all it takes? A self-help journal? Some cry sessions? And one day I'll wake up feeling normal? I asked the kind-eyed man sitting across from me. That's a loaded question. I'm not sure how you want me to answer it. Lie to me. I thought therapy would not only help me, but more important, provide me with a convincing argument to take back to my mother, persuading Ma of her need for treatment. I would find a way to fix her before she was too far gone. But soon I would realize I was too late. You need to come home, Erica frantically said the second I picked up the phone. Ma overdosed. Diary of an Unfit Mind. Things I should be more embarrassed about. Shame is the one thing that prevents us from walking through a supermarket stark-ass nude when we feel like we're having a really good ab day. It is what stops us from telling even our closest confidant of that sex dream we had about Hillary from Love It or List It. And though shame can protect us from extreme embarrassment, it can be detrimentally inhibitive. Personally, I lost all my shame the second I had to participate in a limbo contest on international television. And since then, there is not a damn thing that has the power to embarrass me. I am in charge of my own shame. In the interest of full disclosure and proving myself right, here is a complete list of things I should probably be more embarrassed about, or at the very least have the good sense to never tell anyone. 1. Chopsticks are beyond my comprehension. No matter how hard I try to master them, I always end up looking like an arthritic victim of an arm wrestling accident. 2. Swimming will surely be the death of me. I can't swim because during my formative years, the only pool available to me was a public one, our local newspaper proudly described as back in business now that police have recovered all hypodermic needles. 3. I was the first in line at my local theater to see Pokemon the first movie on opening night, while wearing an unlicensed knockoff Pikachu t-shirt. I was also first in line to see Yu-Gi-Oh! The movie, while wearing a blue-eyes, white-dragon, glow-in-the-dark t-shirt. Because I'm a grade-A gangster. 4. I believe technology has a vendetta against me. It's mostly just the automatic stuff, like auto-flush toilets, motion sensor faucets, sliding doors at the supermarket entrance. I'm convinced that they purposely refuse to acknowledge my existence and that they receive a perverse pleasure out of making me feel like an idiot and or Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense. 5. I believe bugs have a vendetta against me. If there is a mosquito floating around a large group, it will only bite me, and it will bite me 30 times. Every bee instinctively senses my fear and chases me indoors. On separate occasions, a fly, a ladybug, and a moth have kamikazed into my open mouth. 6. I always cry during the Something There musical montage in Beauty and the Beast. The Beast doesn't know how to use a goddamn spoon, so he just shoves his face into the bowl of whatever mystery porridge they were eating, and then everyone makes him feel really uncomfortable about it. Damn, I teared up just saying that. In fact, watching anyone eat while hungry generally makes me want to burst into tears. There's just something both adorable and pitiable about really shoveling it in. Side note, Belle has some pretty intense Stockholm syndrome, no? 7. I once had very real feelings for the fictional video game character Solid Snake, and Buffy's Angel, and Seto Kaiba, and Spike Spiegel, and Vegeta. I'm talking intense and confusing feelings of romantic devotion. I was sure that behind the dark, brooding angst, curmudgeon demeanor, and tortured pasts, these gravelly-voiced anti-heroes were capable of at least an ounce of love and, oh, crap. My marriage suddenly makes complete sense. 8. I burn all my food. On purpose. Burgers, bacon, cheese. Hell, I even burn my eggs. Every douchebag who thinks they're being incredibly original by screaming blasphemy from their ivory douche tower when I order my steak well done needs to take it down a few notches. Rare meat makes me feel like I'm chomping into a human forearm. 9. I'm incapable of eating alone at a restaurant. I don't understand how anyone can do that without crying into their beet salad. They are clearly stronger people than I am. There's no amount of pretending to be busy on my phone that could save me in that situation. And forget going to a movie alone. If I ever tried to purchase a ticket to a movie all by my lonesome, I'm sure I would spontaneously combust into flames. 10. I fear escalators. I eagerly await the day I can step onto an escalator without quietly whispering to myself, "Careful, careful." 11. I keep cereal boxes in the refrigerator. I keep bags of chips in there, too. I'm not a monster. I grew up in such shitty apartment buildings. If any opened bag or box of food was left out overnight, it would undoubtedly be pillaged by a swarm of cockroaches. And when you're 6, it is very easy to mistake a floating roach for a raisin. Understandably, I was scarred for life. 12. I peed the bed when I was 8. The pee traveled so far while I slept, it actually touched the nape of my neck. When I woke up, I simply tiptoed into the bathroom, washed my clothes in the sink, put the wrung-out but still soaking wet clothes onto my body, and crawled back into bed. I'd like to take this moment to apologize to my sister for letting her sleep in a puddle of my urine. as well as blaming it on her in the morning. Chapter 7: The Robin Hood of the Express Checkout Lane. When Grandpa got sick, Dad had traveled back to Puerto Rico to help care for him. He was concerned about leaving Ma alone in New Jersey for a few weeks, but I had promised I would do my best to help out. Unfortunately, a short time later, I received a call from him letting me know Grandpa had passed. Dad, never one to let his guard down, was uncharacteristically emotional. I had never heard my father's voice crack with grief. It was unsettling. I didn't know how I could help, but I offered it anyway. "Actually, if you could break the news to your mom, I'd really appreciate it. I've got a lot of other things to worry about," he asked while fighting tears. "Of course, I can do that. Coffee makes everything better." So I had stopped at the Dunkin' Donuts a block from home before seeing Ma. The employees knew all the Mendez clan by name, since Dad had befriended them upon moving into the neighborhood. They were kind enough to let him open a tab of sorts to get coffee and baked goods on credit, and never made him feel uncomfortable or rushed into paying it back. Dad had to swallow his pride while asking a lot of different owners of local bodegas for credit over the years, and so it was refreshing there was one store in town that treated him with respect, kindness, and generosity. I bought my mother a blueberry muffin and a French vanilla coffee and made my way to her front door. I had expected her to take the news badly, since Grandpa had opened his home to us, and because she empathized with Dad's loss. What I did not expect was for her to wail like a dying animal and hit the floor. The sounds that came out of her were not from this world. She lay shaking, face down on the floor, and using all my strength, I could not budge her from that spot. Yes, I expected her to be sad. We all were. But she did not have a close relationship with her husband's dad. I tried to rationalize her behavior by telling myself that everyone grieves in different ways, but something still felt dangerously off. A week later, a psychiatric hospital found Erica's phone number in Ma's belongings and let her know our mother was involuntarily admitted. Having to deal with the stress of being home alone while my father was still in Puerto Rico, Janet took an almost deadly combination of pills to try to ease her mind. Realizing she was in trouble, she called 911 and reported her accidental overdose. But the hospital considered the overdose a suicide attempt. Her bizarre and aggressive behavior while being treated led them to believe she had suffered a complete mental breakdown, and they admitted her against her will to their psychiatric unit. After a month, Ma not only came home with dozens of crayon drawings she made during therapy sessions, and a story about a nurse stealing her Twizzlers, which, if true, means that nurse deserves to be swiftly kicked in the crotch, but also a much-needed diagnosis. Janet had bipolar disorder, and as discovered through weekly therapy, she had been suffering from its effects for most of her life. Without any of us knowing, she had recently visited a doctor who misdiagnosed her with depression. Antidepressants can have adverse effects on someone with bipolar disorder, and the doctors at the hospital blamed this for her suicide attempt. I thought it was sadly ironic how my mother and I had both secretly sought out treatment at almost the exact same time. We had both initially been diagnosed with depression. Now that I learned she was misdiagnosed, I wondered if it was possible I had been as well. But her bipolar disorder seemed so severe, so consuming, I brushed the thought off. There was no way I was as sick as the woman I was now helping fill out disability paperwork. Ma had to enter a government-funded disability program to be able to afford proper medication. Because of her disability status, Ma was no longer considered capable of paying the student loan she had taken out to help send me to NYU. I could no longer afford to go to school. And honestly, my head was not in the right space to continue anyway. I couldn't focus on anything. I started missing assignments and skipping whole classes. And even though at the end of the semester I had straight A's, my series of unfortunate events led to my leaving NYU. I was heartbroken. I felt like a failure. All I had wanted was to escape the grip of my small town and create my own future for myself, and yet I let circumstances take me down. In the months that followed, I considered every wrong move I had made, playing out countless possible scenarios that could have ended things differently for me. After flying so close to the sun, I was now a cashier at Pathmark Supermarket and living with my parents. The Almost Mighty had fallen very, very far. When you have a job that requires you to serve other people, many parts of that job will unequivocally suck a top hat full of dicks. Whether you are a janitor at a daycare, a cashier at a supermarket, a secretary, a waiter, or a valet driver, the best part of someone's day is going to be shitting atop you. So try and wear a hat, a raincoat, an asshole repellent. You can tell a lot about individuals by how they treat the people they believe are beneath them. People who cannot help them get promoted, who cannot report their actions to human resources, who don't have their level of education or a fraction of their bank account. It is scary to realize what someone is capable of when no one is watching, when no one will hold them accountable for their actions. Basically, it's the exact same attitude people have when using Twitter, but in real life. When you have a job on the lowest tier, when you are meant to be subservient and at the beck and call of someone else, most people will not care about how you're being treated. No one will notice. Working in the service industry means, more often than not, people will look right through you. Sure, you may feel indignant when your barista forgets to say thank you and spells your name wrong on a paper cup, but that is only 30 seconds of your day. Consider how many assholes this barista has had to deal with in the last 5 hours. How many people have not returned his thank you? How many douchebags have spoken to him rudely or questioned his intelligence? Did you hear me say 2% milk? That milk must be 2%. If it's not 2%, I will drop dead right here on your counter, and there's a long line behind me, buddy. It's human nature to want to feel in control, but many people never get that satisfaction. And so when they are in the presence of those they regard as mere commoners who ring up their coffee order or bag their groceries, they will exercise their control to make them feel better about their shitty existence. My father is literally the only person I have ever known who actively tries to engage any and all humans who surround him. I've watched him ask stock boys how their day is going and giggled at how truly shocked and unaccustomed they were to having someone acknowledge their presence. Everyone is equal in his eyes because, as he once eloquently explained, life is a wheel. Some days you're on top, some days you're on the bottom. What's the fucking difference? And that's the mentality I've tried to employ throughout my life and career. Friends, strangers, interns, lighting crew, writers, bosses, what's the fucking difference? It was an attitude I wish more people had when I was a janitor, a cashier, and eventually a secretary. The smallest act of someone smiling at me, saying thank you, or even just making eye contact helped remind me I was an actual human being, and not a robot designed to non-judgmentally swipe customers' lambskin condoms and smile while being yelled at for expired coupons. I tried to make the most of being a cashier. Even though I was making minimum wage, I tried to help pay the rent, and I often spent my meager checks bringing home discounted food from Pathmark. I couldn't afford to go to therapy anymore, and I was too afraid to try the antidepressants hidden in my underwear drawer, so I spent some time researching homeopathic methods to overcoming depression. I tried everything from St. John's wort to B12 pills to fish oil, and maybe those were all kooky placebos, but it felt good to try to take control. Putting the effort in and being proactive was in itself therapeutic. I would feel like I was onto something when my panic attacks and anxiety would eventually subside for long periods of time, but the heightened nerves were only replaced by inexplicably deadened ones. It seemed my brain's only options were to run sprints or to shut down completely. I wasn't sure which was better. The whole world seemed to be drenched in gray, like a foggy mist hung in the air, and everything had a little less life. Nothing pushed me out of bed in the morning. Instead, I felt as if my body were 800 pounds, and I had to peel myself off the sheets. Things I once found excitement and entertainment in barely sparked my interest. My sketchbooks collected dust, while my gaming consoles were only used to get me through the repetitive sleepless nights. I lost count of how many times I got off a shift at 6 p.m., went home to eat the Pathmark find of a 99-cent banquet microwave dinner, and just played Metal Gear Solid Snake Eater until my next shift at 10 a.m. Even food lost its taste, as if every meal was just made out of dry, plain oatmeal. I wanted to worry about these changes, but I didn't have the energy. It was as if my brain knew something was wrong, but my heart was just too numb to give a shit. The only solace that gave me was I no longer felt sad about leaving school. I no longer cried about it every night. I just felt nothing. But I did learn some very valuable life lessons while bagging groceries. Because a grocery store is basically just a microcosm of human behavior. If you carelessly knock over items on a shelf, you probably have a very messy home. If you don't notice you have dropped unwrapped tomatoes on the floor, you probably take your wealth and ability to fill a fridge with food for granted. If you enter a 10 items or less express checkout lane with a fully stocked cart, you are probably inconsiderate and selfishly put your own needs before others. And if you are the type of person who doesn't return your shopping cart to the proper place, but instead leave it in the middle of a parking lot for a teenager to clean up after you, you probably have a mother who cries every night because she gave birth to a monster. The hardest part about working around food in a low-income neighborhood was witnessing how hard it can be for some people to feed their families. I was unlucky enough to ring up several people whose credit cards got denied or Family First food stamp cards hit their limit. Watching someone burn with embarrassment as they have to leave bags of groceries behind and then having to restock dinosaur-shaped nuggets that were clearly meant to feed a little kid really ate away at me. I remembered walking the aisles of ShopRite when I was about 5 years old, holding my mother's hand. Erica stayed back, sleeping in the car with Dad, because she had a nasty cold. We walked through the store briskly and were on our way out without having made a purchase when a security guard grabbed my mother's arm. He pulled her hand out of her coat pocket to reveal a stolen bottle of children's Tylenol. I guess the security guard had seen her swipe something but didn't realize what it was. "I'm sorry, my baby is sick in the car," she pleaded with him. He was clearly stricken with a crisis of conscience. "You shouldn't shop here again," he said as he replaced the bottle into her pocket and hurried her out the door. I never forgot that small act of illegal kindness. Was it wrong to give something away just because it wasn't yours? Would anyone truly get hurt by stealing from a rich corporation to give to the poor? As a fully formed adult, I can sit here and tell you that breaking the law in any way is a deeply stupid move that can have disastrous consequences. But as an 18-year-old with nothing to lose, note to self, research statute of limitations, I gave literally zero fucks about what was right or wrong. Young mothers would approach my register and hesitantly place their baby formula and cereals on the belt. "Can you let me know when it gets close to $50? I don't have more than that left on my card," they would say, referring to their limited, government-funded EBT card. It is basically a debit card that holds someone's food stamp allowance. The items you can purchase with it are restricted to essentials like dairy, vegetables, and bread, and it cannot be used to purchase non-food items like soap, vitamins, medicine, or even hot foods from the supermarket food bar. These are considered luxury items, not necessities. According to the government, diapers are considered a luxury and thus cannot be bought using food stamps. I would watch as these ladies accidentally had baby wipes, diapers, or children's Tylenol in their cart, and 1,000 different emotions would flood through me. And so I did what I thought was right. Each register had a camera fixed on it from above to make sure no one stole money out of the cash till. I would begin the transaction, swiping milk and other approved items, and then I would pause the computer on my register. I would go through the motions of scanning products, but the frozen register wouldn't ring up an item, or seven. With a few presses of a button, the register would turn back on, their total would miraculously come to $30, and the young woman would breathe a sigh of relief. And that made me feel... something? In my new world of deadening monotony, having a rush of good intentions and a feeling of pride and accomplishment, like I had actually done something useful with my day, became a source of addiction. I had helped these customers in what little ways I could, and I tried to make what is normally the shameful process of brandishing food stamps a comfortable, normal experience. A few ladies actually filled out comment cards, thanking me for treating them with respect and not making them feel as small as other cashiers had done. I felt like the ghetto's very own Robin Hood, but with substantially looser-fitting pants. When I was awarded a name badge upgrade for my excellent service, I felt a little guilty. My comment cards and apparent exceptional grocery bagging skills had earned me a faux gold name tag with the phrase 100% performance emblazoned underneath my name. Sure, I had earned the award by breaking the rules, but as a depressed college dropout, I ravenously devoured the crumbs of affirmation. Admittedly, my good deeds began to get a little out of hand. A sweet elderly couple came into the store once a week, and my heart exploded each time they gingerly inched their walking frames up to a register and pulled out a tiny change purse and a wad of expired coupons. As I watched a fellow cashier tell them their coupon for prepackaged cheese slices was no longer usable, I swallowed a knot in my throat when they walked away empty-handed because they simply couldn't afford it without the discount. When they came into my line the next week, they again had expired coupons. I couldn't bear to deny them a simple necessity, a small half gallon of milk, and so I input a code to override the expired coupon message on my register screen and swipe the coupon's barcode as if it were not a year old. The next week, the precious couple was back in my line again. As I tricked the register into accepting their expired coupons, I noticed they had 2 gallons of water on the shelf underneath their cart. It was hard to spot with a conveyor belt between us, and I could tell that was by design. Since they couldn't afford to buy cheese 2 weeks ago, I assumed they were desperate enough to steal the cheap gallons. I felt so awful for them and gladly looked the other way as they pushed the cart hiding 2 stolen jugs of water out of the store. When they came back to my register the next week, I started to get a little pissed. There were, yet again, 2 jugs of water skillfully hidden on the cart's lower shelf, but now, joining the paraphernalia, was a box of Brillo pads. I could understand stealing water, but no old guy was going to fall over dead because he couldn't scrub stubborn eggs off a pan. But I couldn't bring myself to call them out, and as they handed me 2-year-old coupons for a cart full of food, I surrendered into being their dependable partner in crime. Maybe these adorable seniors were just too fragile-minded to realize what they were doing. Maybe they really were desperate to save as much money as they could. When I watched them pull the cart into line at customer service to return all their items, including the stolen ones, for full price, I realized they were actually just crooked motherfuckers. As customer service checked their receipts, they realized I had approved 12 coupons I shouldn't have. The phone at my register rang, and I picked it up to hear a shrill, "Close your register and come to customer service right now." My store manager, my boss, had been manning the counter that day and was about to make me pay. I hung my head and walked past the old crones fighting with her about not getting their money back, and sullenly walked into her office. "I don't want to see you back in my store. You got this girl fired. Are you proud of yourselves?" she yelled as they reluctantly pushed the cart out of the store. "I don't give a fuck," the once adorable old lady yelled from her filthy thug mouth on the way out. "I thought we were partners in crime, lady." Turns out, I was just an easy mark for these criminal masterminds. I wouldn't have been surprised to see them pull off their old people masks in the parking lot, jump into a running convertible, and speed away while flipping me off. I could, and probably should, fire you right now, the store manager began. I don't know why you would think it's okay to approve expired coupons and cost my store money, but I'm just going to take that money out of your check. If it happens again, you're out of here. Okay, I'm sorry, I managed to squeak out. That doesn't sound like a thank you, she said as I stood up to leave the room. Now, the woman had every right to Cammy right there, and I appreciated that she hadn't. But the way she phrased that sentence just rubbed me wrong. As if I was supposed to grovel at the chance to continue making minimum wage. As if I was supposed to be happy that week's $100 paycheck would now be reduced to 50. Sure, I owed the store that money, and was lucky I wasn't being dragged into shopping mall jail. But she was trying to make me feel even smaller than wearing a blue smock and scrubbing butcher meat blood off a belt 10 times a day already did. Now she wanted me to swallow my pride and thank her? Fuck that noise. This was not the life I was supposed to be living. A year ago, I was a student at a prestigious school, living on my own and trying to turn art into an actual career. I refused to grovel for $50. I was worth so much more. No, thank you, I calmly responded as I unpinned my name badge, tucked it into my pants pocket, and handed the manager my smock. As I walked out of the building, I realized I hadn't actually said the words I quit. To this day, I wonder if they're still waiting for me to show up to my afternoon shift. No matter. I was done throwing myself a pity party and living in shades of gray. I made it home in a daze. I think my brain was trying to panic about being jobless, but my body was too tired to notice. As I hopped into a steaming shower, my mind began to drift off. The scalding hot water felt painfully good against my skin. I sank down to sit cross-legged on the floor of the tub and closed my eyes beneath the heavy water. I felt my mind drift away from my body. I looked at the sad little creature beneath me. She had failed at school, failed at work, even failed at being a daughter. And now she was no one, just a small girl in a bathtub talking to herself. And then I made a decision. Stand the fuck up. Cry out whatever tears you have left and let them rinse away down the drain. Today was a wash, yet another failure to add to the list. Today I would allow myself to cry about it, but force myself to realize there was nothing I could do to change the past. Whatever pain and depression I was feeling could have today, but it could not have tomorrow. Diary of an Unfit Mind. My irrationally long list of irrational feelings. Things that make me irrationally scared. Revolving doors. The first step on a moving walkway. The last step off an escalator. Food that is close to the sell-by date. Cats sitting higher than the height of my face on a staircase I am walking up. Cats. When I am walking at a brisk pace toward an automatic door and it still hasn't opened. Spiders / lint that could be confused for a spider from far away. The oil popping while cooking. Being chased. Even as a joke, I will drop into the fetal position, cover my eyes, and curse at you. My teeth scraping on a wooden popsicle stick. Accidentally incurring the wrath of a shaman. Flipping a sunny-side-up egg. Things that make me irrationally angry. Children doing choreography. Sitting in a seat someone has just sat in and it's still warm. Children with inexplicably sticky hands. Strangers who ask, "Where do I know you from?" and expect you to start guessing. The B-52 song, Love Shack. People who quote other people while doing an impression of that person. women who use the phrase, my man. Men in V-necks. Men in sandals. Backhand compliments, like, I love how you don't care what you look like without makeup. Red nail polish. How no one from It's Sunny in Philadelphia has won an Emmy yet. Old people in movies using slang like get jiggy with it. It's not funny. It's never funny. When people use sad face emojis while texting about tragic events. Toe socks. Things that make me irrationally happy. Coffee. When Lori and Barbara are on the Shark Tank panel at the same time. When old people kiss on the kiss cam. When someone refuses to kiss on the kiss cam and the kiss cam awkwardly stays on them for too long. The sound of dogs drinking water. The sound of a wooden dresser drawer opening and or closing. Right angles. The tears of my enemies. That corn chip smell dogs get when they're sleepy. Destiel fanfics. Overweight pigeons. Watching someone pull a door they are supposed to push and then get super confused. Megan Fox. When chefs cut themselves on Chopped. More coffee. Children cursing. When dogs audibly fart and scare themselves. Chapter 8, Born Again. I am not very good at doing anything halfway. There is something about the middle ground that makes me want to jackhammer it into a steep hill and then watch things violently roll down it. People tend to find too much comfort in half measures. They want everyone to like them. And so they never say anything too offensive. They never pick a side in an argument, so they don't lose a future ally. They don't allow themselves to love completely, so they avoid getting hurt. They never take too strong a stand on what they believe in, for fear of standing alone. But for me, there's excitement in extremes. When I love with every ounce of my twisted soul. And when friendships or relationships go south, I tend to set them on fire just to make sure they're really dead. Because as the wise young scholar Dylan McKay once said, may the bridges I burn light my way. If I have to apply to college, I'm going to put all of my eggs into one basket and try to get into one of the most prestigious art schools in the country. If I'm going to work at a supermarket, you bet your sweet ass I'm going to be awarded with a gold name tag within a month. And when I decide to get off my ass and make something of my life, there's not a damn thing that is going to stop me. I had tried the traditional route, touted in after-school specials and preached by practical adults. Go to school, live off your parents, get a 9-to-5 job, don't make too many waves, and politely wait for death. Living off my parents wasn't going to be an option like it was for the majority of the kids I encountered at college. I helped pay the bills since I was 15. I tried to go to school and get myself out of my small town, but somehow ended up right where I started. If insanity really was doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, I was going to have to change things up. I tried making my academic dreams come true, and that was a bust. So now it was time to dust myself off and explore that other childhood fantasy. While most people would love to be the wild thing they'd dreamed of as a wide-eyed child, actually jumping in with both feet to make it happen seems like an absurd indulgence. There is no safety in that. There are no guarantees, like there would be, say, working your way up the Pathmark corporate ladder. But at 18, I had nothing to lose. And so, I made up my mind. When I was 12 years old, I promised myself I would become a real-life superhero. I would be strong and powerful, brave and independent. This scrawny, 5'2", 100-pound asthmatic nerd with knotted hair and acne, was going to join the supermodels and bodybuilders before her and somehow, some way, become a professional wrestler. So first things first, I needed money. While at the time most women in professional wrestling were scouted for modeling jobs, that most certainly was not going to be my way in. I've always been fine with my looks, but that's not because I think I'm conventionally attractive. I know I'm nowhere near a model. On my best day, with the assistance of highly skilled professionals, I'm a television 6, which equals a solid Jersey 8. And that doesn't mean I'm insecure or a fisher of compliments. I'm just comfortable with my appearance in the same way a dog is comfortable licking his crotch in the center of a crowded room. It is what it is. And if you're uncomfortable looking at me, that's your own damn problem. I think that's mostly because I've never put much stock in my appearance. The majority of my life was spent in sweats, with my dirty hair pulled back to accentuate my troubled skin. I just didn't care, and the act of not caring what anyone thought made me feel incredibly free. Being comfortable with myself meant not needing the approval of others to build my confidence. That's not something any caring adult taught me. No one gently guided me into womanhood by helping me see my inner beauty. I just innately knew my value. I knew it because the world seemed to be denying it, and that just made me want to prove it even more. My value was not in my looks, but in my mind. I knew I was smart, funny, creative, and tough. What I brought to the world was going to be something of my mind's creation, not my body's. But I also knew the pro wrestling industry had a high standard of beauty, which I just couldn't measure up to. I figured I could just fake my way through that particular requirement somewhere down the line. But to get my foot in the door and to one day make an indelible mark, I was going to have to bring something else, something undeniable, to the table. What really mattered and what was truly lacking in the landscape was skill. There was a glorious golden age for women in wrestling over a decade back, when the roster had plenty of talented, well-rounded athletes who were just as physically imposing as their male counterparts. But over time, the major companies had repackaged the concept of a female wrestler. Now the majority were amazing to look at, but not so amazing inside of the ring. So the only examples I had of female successes were jacked-up Amazonian goddess-like weightlifters, or drop-dead, gorgeous, voluptuous sexpots. On a scale of 1 to 10, I was a negative 14 for both categories. I couldn't change that, but what I could control was how good a wrestler and performer I would become. I knew what my currency could be, and it wasn't going to be found in any of the trails made before me. I was going to have to create my own path. And for that, I needed professional training. But for professional training, I needed a lot of money. So the day after my Pathmark walkout, I opened a newspaper and called literally every wanted ad. Even if I had none of the skills they were looking for, I called every office building, every store in a 30-mile radius. Eventually, a small prepaid calling card company two towns over invited me to interview for a secretary position. With virtually no experience, I got the part-time job. After 2 days, I talked my way into making the position full-time. I went from making around $100 a week to about $300, and at the time, I genuinely thought I had entered the highest of tax brackets. Though I wanted to swim atop a bed covered in my hard-earned fistful of bills, instead, I opened my first bank account. I had a game plan and a debit card. I was on my way to becoming a full-fledged adult. Wrestling schools around the world can often be heartless scams meant to take money from clueless wannabes with lofty dreams. I wasn't sure if the school I found in an empty warehouse on a sketchy Jersey street was one of those, but I knew for sure if that was how they saw me. An all-too-small, incapable wannabe who was trying to enter a world she wasn't tough enough for. I know this because the owner of the school came out and told me so. You know this hurts, right? You're a little girl, and you could get really injured. But if you want to pay the tuition, you're in. Anyone who knows me knows that the best way to ensure I do something is to tell me that I can't. That's how I learned that dolls will surely melt in a microwave, and domesticating a squirrel can be dangerous. And so my first few paychecks went to putting a down payment on wrestling school. The owner, though doubtful of my ability to actually survive the training, was kind enough to let me pay in installments. Every 2 weeks, a portion of my check would go to putting myself through wrestling training, a fact that my